Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University, this is Voices of Public Intellectuals. I'm your host, Florence Ladd. This week's program features Claire Dalton, professor of law at Northeastern University School of Law and executive director of the Domestic Violence Institute. Professor Dalton is speaking about the impact of violence on women's civic participation. Here to introduce Professor Dalton is Dr. Tamar March, Dean of Educational Programs.
It is really a pleasure to welcome you all on behalf of the Graduate Consortium in Women's Studies and the Radcliffe Seminars, and to see such a full house. It is with considerable pride that I introduce to you the person for whom you have turned out this evening, Claire Dalton. Born and raised in England, she holds an undergraduate degree in jurisprudence from Oxford University and an LL degree from Harvard Law School. Prior to joining Northeastern Law Faculty in 1988, she taught at American University's Washington College of Law and at Harvard Law School, and practiced for 4 years with the Washington, D.C. firm of Covington and Burling. The Domestic Violence Institute, founded by Professor Dalton shortly after she joined Northeastern in 1988, is dedicated to helping women who are experiencing abuse. Working closely with partners in the community, its special role is to provide legal advocacy services to battered women seeking legal protection for themselves and their children, to train lawyers and other professionals to meet the unique challenges of working with battered clients, and to foster the interdisciplinary relationships and learning that can make the system work for women who seek assistance. In addition to the support the Institute receives from Northeastern University, its work has been recognized and funded by the U.S. Department of Education, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the Department of Justice, the National Institute for Justice, and the George Soros Foundation. She is currently co-authoring a textbook on domestic violence and the law to be published later this year by the Foundation Press. The title of tonight's presentation is The Impact of Violence on Women's Civic Participation. Welcome, Professor Dalton.
I want to thank the Graduate Consortium and the Radcliffe Seminars for this invitation, which I very much appreciate, and I want to thank you all for coming. As I have been pondering my title and my talk, I have alternately thought about it as the impact of violence on women's civic participation and the relationship between violence and women's civic participation. And I've come to realize that my starting point has to be the proposition that violence against women today is still a public practice as well as a private practice, that it continues to enforce broadly accepted or tolerated norms about what women are for, where they belong, and what they may and may not do, even as it exacts a terrible and often excruciatingly private price from individual women. Only from this starting place will I be able to end where I would like to end, which is with two rather grim conclusions about the continuing relationship between violence against women and their civic participation, and then two more hopeful assertions about why the story can be expected to have more chapters and ultimately a happier ending. The grim conclusions, so as not to leave you guessing, are first that since the state in its official capacity and society more generally are still relatively ineffective in curbing men's private violence towards women, Women to that extent are still not, in reality, the full and equal citizens the Constitution and laws promise they will be. The full and equal citizens we tend to imagine, for the most part, they are. They are not, in other words, receiving their full due from the state. Second, violence against women in its daily and most mundane exercise concretely impedes women's participation in civic and political life and diminishes their contribution to it. Women are not yet in a position to give the state the full measure of what they have to offer, which may in turn explain why we are not making faster progress towards the first goal. The more hopeful assertions, well, perhaps I should keep those to myself until we get there. We do not any longer, for the most part, formally tolerate violence against women. Married men no longer have the right under law to discipline their wives. Beyond that, state legislatures have been very active in the last 25 or 30 years in creating new tools to address domestic violence and stalking. The marital rape exemption has been repealed in many states and limited in its operation in most others. We are beginning to recognize sexual assault in the workplace for what it is, even if the harasser and the target know one another. And we are even prepared on occasion to sanction the employer who tolerates it for discriminating against his women employees. We have coined the word date rape, which on the one hand sounds less serious than stranger rape, and yet at least acknowledges that rape is possible in the context of a dating relationship. And yet, domestic violence, meaning broadly violence between married or intimate or dating partners, is rampant. So is sexual harassment in the workplace. So is sex between young people that hardly meets the definition of intercourse freely consented to. And no sooner does the law confront one of these contested territories and begin to elaborate new norms, make new demands on behalf of women, then these efforts are discredited, ridiculed, and attacked in a highly public and political way. It could, of course, be that this is because the efforts are wrong-headed, or misdirected, or clumsy, or trample on rights of higher priority than women's participation as full and equal citizens in this society. But there I reveal my suspicion, which is that while individual initiatives on behalf of women may indeed miss the mark on occasion or prove blunt instruments in need of refinement or adjustment, the intensity of the opposition to them has much more to do with the fact that as a society, we do still resist at a fundamental level the idea that women's concerns, their needs, their perceptions, and even their rights are as valid, as legitimate, as deserving of recognition and protection as men's. The intensity of that resistance may not have changed much since John Stuart Mill said about it in 1869. So long as an opinion is strongly rooted in the feelings, it gains rather than loses in stability by having a preponderating weight of argument against it. And there are so many causes tending to make the feelings connected with this subject the most intense and most deeply rooted of all those which gather round and protect old institutions and customs, that we need not wonder to find them as yet less undermined and loosened than any of the rest by the progress of the great modern spiritual and social transition. Nor suppose that the barbarisms to which men cling longest must be less barbarous than those which they earlier shake off. My hypothesis going forward, then, is that practices of violence against women still have as one of their meanings the subordination, or as John Stuart Mill would have said, the subjection of women. Violence against women is still, that is to say, about power, and it is about the power of men over women. This understanding competes with others. Let me list just a few. One, since violence in the home or the workplace or on the street is not only directed at women, it cannot be construed as having particular meaning for women in their relationships with men. 2. Violence is the consequence of individual pathology or poor impulse control in the perpetrator. 3. Violence is about conflict. 4. Violence is nothing more than the consequence of a misunderstanding or a mistake. This is very often found in the cases about whether sex in the workplace or on a date has been consented to. There are some interesting things you could say about these competing explanations. First, they all privatize violence, denying it any larger public meaning. Second, the pathology explanation is the only one that concedes that the perpetrator lacks the respect for others consistent with a commitment to equality. Third, the others all assume equality. Conflict is assumed to be conflict between equals. The misunderstandings are assumed to be miscommunications between equals. Now, in the face of these competing explanations, the question is next, where would we derive support for the idea that instead violence is still tied to older ideas about male power and women's subordination? Older ideas about where women belong and where they don't. Older ideas about male entitlement and the illegitimacy of women saying no to men. In the rape context, perhaps we would find it in the uphill struggle women still face, in persuading tribunals, whether university disciplinary committees or judges and juries, that they did not give consent when they knew the men who assaulted them. In a battle over the meaning of conduct or of words, many would say there is continuing evidence that men's interpretations are privileged over women's. We might find evidence in the conviction of countless women in work environments that to challenge inappropriately sexualized behavior on the part of male superiors or even peers is to put oneself at risk. I hear this with disheartening frequency from young women lawyers in some of Boston's premier law firms, lest any of us are harboring any comforting illusions about the kinds of workplaces where this might be true. In the sexual harassment context again, we might find evidence in the common practice of reassigning the complaining woman rather than her offending male supervisor. Even if her complaint is heard, in other words, her career continuity, her comfort, perhaps even her advancement are sacrificed to his too often. We might find evidence in the intense hostility towards women in traditionally male workplaces, where the sexualization of the workplace, whether through pornographic displays or gropings, is tied explicitly to language about women being where they aren't wanted and don't belong. And in the domestic violence context, we can find evidence in very explicit statements by abusive men about their use of violence as a sanction for disobedience or insubordination or as a reinforcement of the prerogative of ownership. If I can't have you, no one will. More generally, we could also derive support for the idea that private violence is still attached to ideas about male entitlement and power by noting how often it continues by other means, restrictions on women that in the not-too-distant past were legally sanctioned or enforced, such as the exclusion of women from participation in the professions and many other forms of employment, or the legal subordination of women to men in marriage. John Stuart Mill saw a progression from the exercise of brute force against women to the milder, more legally based restrictions of his own day. As we do away with the overt state-sanctioned machinery of women's subordination, it seems we are leaving to private enforcers the last-ditch efforts to sustain the old order. Must we choose between this politicized understanding of violence or the competing privatized understandings I have acknowledged? There is a way to reconcile them. The argument would be that the practices of violence can be viewed as both and, in a context in which we as a society choose to blind ourselves to the extent to which the subordination of women is still an active aspect of our functioning. The confused and hurt male student accused of date rape may well be, because of his cultural conditioning, his training in what to expect from women, unable subjectively to hear or read the message that his advances are not welcome. The male supervisor may be so convinced that his insistent invitations are made to a willing audience that he fails to consider his or his employee's behavior in the context of his power over a subordinate. The husband who beats his wife for a dinner late or a floor unswept may experience the incident as a conflict in which he was provoked to violence. She knows I can't stand it when, without stopping to consider that the rules he is enforcing are ones which his partner had no hand in shaping, and that the provocation he experiences is nothing more than an assault to his authority and control. The partner who comes home from a bad day at work and picks a fight that escalates to violence may indeed experience himself as having lost control under highly stressful circumstances, without stopping to consider why it is he has controlled his impulse to punch out the boss or co-worker and not his impulse to attack his partner. What about the argument that women are not the only targets of violence and should not therefore understand the violence directed at them as having a gendered meaning? Well, of course, women are not the only people violated by others. On the other hand, violence is always directed at those with least power to complain, or at those who most threaten their aggressor's comfortable sense of themselves and their place in society, or at those who are scapegoated by popular culture and blamed for circumstances that are depriving their aggressors of control over their own lives. So, violence is disproportionately directed at children, at people with mental and physical disabilities, at foreigners, at racial and ethnic minorities, at gay and lesbian people, and at women. But when violence is directed at women, it is indeed often directed at them because they are women in a way that is tied to the history of women's subordination. Just as when violence is directed at gay and lesbian people, it is directed at them because of our cultural history of homophobia. What I'd like to do now is to share with you some recent theorizing that aims to bolster this idea that what it is tempting to describe as private practices of violence, undoubtedly extremely damaging to individual women, but already condemned by the formal apparatus of the state, is actually a continuation of a social and sanctioned tradition of women's subordination, to date quite ineffectively addressed by the state. But now my context is going to become more specific, because this theory comes out of the field in which I work, which is the field of domestic violence. Is this narrowing of scope going to affect the generalizability of the argument? I will leave you to judge. But my thought is that the family is the crucible in which we first learn about relationships between men and women, so that violence at home, with its messages about control and subordination, is in an important sense the template for violence elsewhere. To set the stage for the theory, I want to describe just briefly some of the features of long-term abusive relationships, so that you have a way to connect the theory to the social reality out of which it grows. This description, then, is no longer about what violence means, but about what it does, the forms and the consequences of violence. But I need one more caveat before I begin, and that is that not all abusive relationships are alike. Some women are lucky enough to recognize their peril early and get out before the violence escalates. Some have the resilience to fight back for an extended period of time, never letting their partner achieve the control that is his goal. In some relationships, one or two violent episodes serve as backdrop and silent threat, keeping women in place and in line in relationships marked more by emotional than by physical abuse. It is crucial, in other words, both to recognize the patterns and commonalities of abuse and to resist stereotyping or the assumption that every woman's experience is the same. John Stuart Mill, who has been, as you can tell, my constant companion over the last several weeks, says it about as well as anyone. He is talking about the legal subjection of women to their partners under 19th century English law, but he might as well be talking about the practical subjection of a woman to her physically abusive partner. The possessors of the power, he says, have facilities in this case greater than in any other to prevent any uprising against it. Every one of the subjects lives under the very eye and almost, it may be said, in the hands of one of the masters. In struggles for political emancipation, everybody knows how often its champions are bought off by bribes or daunted by terrors. In the case of women, each individual of the subject class is in a chronic state of bribery and intimidation combined. For our purposes, then, here are some of the central features of long-term violent or abusive relationships. They are relationships of coercive control. They are relationships in which the abused partner serves the needs of the abusive partner. They are relationships full of rules. Charlotte Fedders was married to the chairman of the SEC. His rules for her included that no one, including guests and their toddler children, could wear shoes in the house, that the furniture had to be at all times in the same indentations on the carpet, that the vacuum marks on the carpet had to be parallel, and that any sand that spilled out of the children's sandbox had to be removed from the surrounding grass. She was not permitted to write checks from their joint checking account. Any infraction of these rules could result in a beating. One Harvard law student printed out a multi-page single-space list of the rules for his partner, lest there be any misunderstanding about her obligations or any question about the justice of his beatings when she broke the rules. They are relationships that isolate. Abused partners are often not permitted to visit with family or friends, and certainly not unless accompanied by the abusive partner. They often are not permitted to drop the children at school or pick them up. They cannot join book clubs or the PTA or neighborhood associations or churches unless they join with their partner. The isolation includes isolation from educational and employment opportunities. Abused partners are often forbidden to go to school, forbidden to participate in training programs, to attend seminars or lectures. They are equally forbidden to take jobs. The forbidding can be explicit or it can be disguised. A woman may find that the outfit she has set aside for her job interview has been slashed so that it cannot be worn. The partner who has promised he will babysit while she takes an important exam may not show up at the designated time. She may end up with a black eye at 8:30 in the morning, which precludes her out of shame from going to work. Not only are women precluded from participation in labor outside the home, but their access to the family's economic resources is usually tightly controlled. Charlotte Fedder's experience of not being able to write a check is very common. Money may be parceled out for groceries or other family expenses, but women generally have no discretionary funds, even for the smallest and most personal of needs, like a haircut, a lipstick, or a magazine. These are relationships that fundamentally erode the abused partner's sense of herself. Physiologically, she may be depressed, anxious, suffering from sleep disturbances, having intrusive flashbacks to violent incidents, or suffering from a hypervigilance that affects her capacity to concentrate, the whole range of symptoms associated with post-traumatic stress. Psychologically, she is constantly on the receiving end of messages that undercut her sense of competence, her sense of worth, her very sense of self. Her accounts of her experiences are challenged. Her opinions are ridiculed. Her judgment is constantly undermined and critiqued. Nothing she does is good enough. No one else would put up with her. She is lucky to be living with someone who can correct and guide her and prevent her from making a fool of herself with others. These relationships can be ones in which violence is a constant source of pain and debility, or in which threats of violence, whether directed against her and the children or other family members or friends, can be a constant source of terror.
You're listening to Voices of Public Intellectuals with Claire Dalton.